This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
Hi, I'm George Quasha.
Oh, really?
So, what do you want to know? We haven't decided to say anything particular to you tonight, just to be here. So we'll just watch you and you watch us. But you know, you can ask questions to Gary if you like, and we'll answer them for him. But actually, the work that we do with and for and about Gary is, oh, God, it's kind of a love affair. We're not in that kind of relationship, actually. But it is a love affair. It is something that began 3 decades ago, and we met in the usual casual way that people meet, and then began to sort of transform each other's lives. And that hasn't stopped, strangely enough. After all these years, we still do it. And I, who am a committed non-critic, non-writer about other people's work, have spent a huge amount of my life writing about one person. As Chuck said, next lifetime you have to write about us. I mean, it's very interesting to find yourself in a situation where what you most want to say about what you think is most important about reality, language, art, can be said, in fact, in the context of talking about another person. That in itself, to me, is perhaps the big event about this rather heavy book that I recommend that nobody drop on their foot. The biggest thing about that book is its weight. But it's actually an amazing fact that a book like that could be, because it really is the result of, well, it was 12 or 13 years where we wrote about Gary on request and found that we were writing our own sense of the world, which doesn't mean that we were imposing, I really don't think it means that we were imposing a view on him, but that we were finding that it was possible to say, and there's no category for this kind of writing in my view, that the things that we most wanted to say about life, reality, art, required the objectivity, in a sense, of another person's work. It was always our wish to be accurate, objective, clear about what he does, never to express ourselves, quote, and yet it always produced that thing that we didn't know was possible for us to think and say, and I think that was, for me, the big event about it.
If we hadn't been writing about Gary, we would have been trying to write about poetry, but the context of contemporary literary critical theory and was not really congenial to the kinds of things we wanted to explore in terms of general ideas about poetics or general ideas about making, not necessarily about writing poetry and lines or without lines or various things that poetry are. So the possibility of writing, I don't know, am I...
I'm a little closer to your mouth. You know?
No, okay, yeah, there we go. Okay, no, we got
Dr. it. Dr. Your lapel.
Hello.
Hello, lapel.
What we came to in writing about Gary was not only that we were writing about another person, but that we were writing about a medium that was in the process of creating itself. Because it isn't as if Gary were a video artist or could be confined to that kind of a concept that would exist in general through 6 or 7 or 411 people who call themselves video artists. The way in which his work transformed the very notion of the relationship between creativity and the stuff one works with in trying to discover what it is one is making is unique to him, but not unique to something about the contemporary state of creativity, say, as art or something more general than art even. So it became much more propitious to study with him as he was studying his own process and contribute to it in what ways we have and can and do. than to be writing about poetry, which is have been both of our own major concerns over the years and continues to be.
Yeah.
Do you agree?
No, I mean, my mind is shooting off in many different directions. I mean, first, I just want to say that every word last, you know, the other night we were at dinner and we were sitting there putting our quotations around every word that we said because every word kind of all of a sudden explodes, implodes, and whatever. But that's, you know, beside the point anyway. I know these guys for 30 years, and they have deeply influenced, you know, my work, my thinking, my way of life.
Implode, come on.
I'm trying to. It seems like in retrospect, you know, people ask, you know, they talk about video art, how did you get into video, or all these questions about video. And finally, although in retrospect it seems so obvious, in this book, it said quite clearly, well, clearly but constructed and beautifully laid out, that no, I'm not a video artist, I'm a language artist. And this seems so naturally so, even though I'm not a writer. That may sound contradictory, but I work somehow in the realm of language that resides between where you accept, knowing something, and where you say, well, maybe not. It's a kind of between space where, things happen, and really has nothing to do with video. Maybe it has nothing to do with language. Maybe it's just this, continuously trying to get yourself into, a here and now point that never becomes a point, that becomes, where you're, in a becoming state, and you manifest this as materials avail themselves to you, as people's ideas avail themselves to you, as the world unfolds the way it does, and for whatever reason you make things, ideas, like having to do with this exhibition here right now. I mean, I'm trying to be realistic, with you. You do exhibitions here and there, and this, what is that context? What is the situation? We had a lot of problems with this book. A lot of time, a lot of frustration. And we kind of, at least pinpointed this to this event. What would make sense with the book, and what could I do to make something happen that's just not just an artifact, or this is a documentary of the book and the works that are in the book. And there was a moment where, because I had just made this work that was in the front room, up against down, that you get these flashes that, okay, I now understand what this exhibition could be about. Exhibition meaning work. The exhibition can be a work. It can be an absolute happening. It is a happening. And so the idea of having this, some of that, it is a here and now work. It's current, but it's very physical. You walk through that. You're kind of like filtered through physicality into, this more perhaps cerebral, at least on first intention, perhaps not, works that deal with language, perhaps not. And then this presentation, this book, in a kind of between state of this physicality and I don't know if I'm making any sense here or not, but anyway, whatever. It's just a smear of words that I'm throwing out there.
Why don't you say something about the stuff that the three of us did together that's here?
Well, that's everything.
Well,
kind of.
Yeah, like the video of us chattering, what that is.
Yeah.
We couldn't talk about that. I mean, we've said what we had to say, so.
Well, okay, yeah, there's a work here called Figuring Grounds, which is really from a recording session, where we also did a work called Tell Enclosure in 1985. And somewhat this came out because, in my memory, I could be just creating this right now. I mean, obviously, it's 20 years old, whatever. Kind of like, you know, we're living in this space, we're doing all these things, we're thinking, talking, late nights, all this kind of stuff, you know. We have to try and do something in this thing, you know. Like, so I think it was somewhat like, okay, let's just get the camera and, you know, do it, you know, something, you know. And this first work, I recorded them and set up a kind of feedback, meaning that they're seeing what I'm recording at the moment, so that they can see the image that I'm recording, and they can respond to that image. I mean, this is kind of classic early video, the beauty of video, in fact, that what video really is, where, you know, you're using feedback to respond to and enfold and infect the feedback, so you have feedback upon feedback upon feedback. And the nature of what they're doing, the language sound that they're making, is not just about variation or collage or the possibility of sounds, but in fact, you can actually feel the reach for kind of the fundament of language. It's not just making sounds, it's a dance around perhaps the etymological and, you know, sound root of what is taking place. And they're moving around this space and reflecting upon the camera moving around that space as they're moving around a space. So you have a kind of spiral of image, language, and sound that are moving. and so, you know.
Well, the context of doing it was that we had been doing performances in this kind of sound poetry world for some years. And we had been doing a lot of it at that time. In fact, earlier that year, we had made a recording for Ripley's Believe It or Not, in which they came and recorded us doing this kind of stuff.
Was later.
Huh?
What was that? Was after.
No. It was early in 85. And it was because we had been doing it in that space, which is also the same space as Muddles, Why Do Things Get Into Muddles? And it was the same room, which is a building on George's property. But we've been doing a lot of this, and the idea that you would come in and work with us and try to see what happened if you recorded us—that was basically the idea. Mm. And so we did many, many hours of it. That's right. It must be
three
hours. Okay. So two pieces of short were made by Gary over many years. This was 85, and this piece was just finished.
It took place. You know, the event took place in 3 hours, and then one work, Tell Enclosure, which is actually not here, but we may kind of make that here, was an excerpt of a real-time moment of this 3 hours. The work that is here, Figuring Grounds, was an edit from this space, which is, you know, quite different than a real-time thing, but it's still, the idea was to include the sense of what was happening at that time. I just want to say, this is kind of jumping tracks here, is that really, this is because I came upon this thought recently. I'm really kind of an when they say outsider art, my roots are really as an outsider art thing. I mean, I started making art when I was very young. At that point, it was not really necessarily even art. It was just there was a friend of a brother of a friend who made these strange sculptures that looked kind of like Hieronymus Bosch and Giacometti on LSD. I was 15, and I was on LSD, and I got involved in this somehow by this. And I was very obsessed, and that's all I did this for 6 hours a day from then on. I made these welded sculptures, these strange things. And only recently do I realize what that, like, kind of means when this kind of phrase, outsider art. I mean, in fact, I realized maybe I really don't understand what that means. Because what is it to be outside, and what is inside? What defines inside? Anyway, and in certain ways, meeting with George and Chuck, realizing what the inside is, and making art, I kind of re-met the outside. That may have very well have a kind of consciousness of inside. It's there, but let's not get too close to that. Let's deal with this space between inside and outside, and see if we can bulge it out so that it disturbs the outside and the inside. Does this make any sense, Paul?
Yeah.
So. I think that's, in a way, that's really what what I do, and I think perhaps what George and Chuck do on different and same levels, is this work on this kind of between place where it's not about avoiding, it's not about, deciding not being this or being that, but keeping something alive and tuning and going and opening and just making love with the mysterious. What can I say?
I want to say something. I don't know what it is exactly, how to say it, but Gary's description of himself is really interesting to me, because he really actually touches upon something that is very hard to say inside the art culture. He calls himself an outsider artist. Obviously, he's a highly developed, articulate artist who dialogues with the best ideas or the most powerful ideas in art and philosophy and thought in many ways. He doesn't represent himself that way, but that's really true. At the same time, I've always felt that Gary was very close to something very raw about art in life, something that comes from a level of necessity that is possibly personal, possibly really non-personal, but it was very difficult to characterize it. But it has a force and drive within it that keeps it at the edge of itself at all times. Gary doesn't know what he's doing much of the time. He thrives at the edge of what he knows. That's where he works. There are great artists who have powerful control over all aspects of their thought and medium. It's not about whether you're doing the right kind of art or the wrong kind of art. It's the what kind of art are you doing? And Gary works in areas where he's discovering what it is to be in everything that he does. It has that kind of urgency and authenticity about it. It's impossible for me to engage myself with Gary's work without being altered in some way. And it's very interesting because I just wrote this big book that's the result of many years, and I thought, that's it. No more about Gary Hill. I'm not writing about him anymore, no matter what. You know. And then I remembered we're having this show, and they asked me to write another piece. And so for a couple of weeks, I resisted pulling my hair out because I would have to write something again. And then he sent me the basis of this piece that you see as you're coming in here called Up Against Down, the big piece that makes all the noise. It's really difficult to be in the presence of for very long. And I'll tell you something. As soon as I started writing about that piece, the whole thing started up all over again. It's as though I'd never written about him, and I had no existing...
It's like a Gary drug.
Yeah, it's like a drug. He's kind of a drug. He ought to be written by prescription. You know, avoid kids in the presence of Gary Hill. I mean, he is a subversive artist in a very particular sense that doesn't have to do with his idea of being subversive. He has no he doesn't have those kinds of social intentions. He has that kind of social impact and effect. But he doesn't sit around thinking, how can I subvert society? He just does. If you actually sit in the presence of his work, and the problem with actually what's great about this show is that you can actually see all these pieces here. The slot folks are really fantastic in that way. They let us do what would work in this space, and they worked with us to make it happen in a very particular way. The way that these pieces are shown here, you can really get this thing that I'm talking about. I kind of dare people to go spend much time in that room over there in the corner. I did write a piece about that, and basically about a while back for a catalog that's now in the book. But I'll tell you, that piece never ceases to be challenging in exactly the level that its challenge exists for him. Gary made the piece before when he had to kind of a deadline, and he did the piece all in a sweep, and it's got the energy of its own difficulty within it. You can't see the piece without registering the particular thing that is. I just learned something since all this time of having written about him that I never knew, that he'd had the idea for that piece years before. It's actually been a thought that came into his mind. What would it be like, correct me if I'm wrong, what would it be like to, what would happen to language if it was spoken at the moment that the impact of the body against the wall and the thing spoken is at the same time? That's the kind of a, you know, question you have about language. It would shows the way his pieces happen. They happen out of a flash of an idea that is a really exciting question for him about the nature of something, language in a particular context, language under the stress of a particular set of actions and procedures that are familiar to him in his mind, and that's the way that he works. And then the piece is a kind of working out of the question. Now, I brought this up to a group of folks, some of them are here, the other day when I said, my problem with art history is that it often makes assumptions on the basis of things that are actually not really true when you really get down to it. Now, let's take the piece here, wall piece. Throwing himself against the wall, saying one word of a 500-word text until that text is done, okay? The piece could strike you as belonging to a kind of category of pieces that, on one hand, would be called man throws himself against the wall, all right? I mean, that's not nothing, because there was a very powerful piece like that made by Barry LeVay 30 years or so before that, in which he ran for 50, whatever it was, feet, or something, just enough to get a hell of a momentum in Ohio, and the gallery, I think it was Ohio State, and threw himself against the wall with all the force that he could do. And it must have been an amazing thing to witness if anybody actually did the whole thing. It must have been really excruciating. And that puts that piece, not only man throws himself against the wall, but it kind of is, it belongs not only to the minimalist understanding and the conceptual understanding that were all being kind of worked out in new ways at that time, but it also belongs to what would become endurance art, right? Chris Burden, Marina Abramović, and all of that, okay? Gary's piece has nothing to do with either of those two things. It has nothing to do with endurance. I mean, it was great that he endured in that the peace happened. But he really wasn't interested in the question of what happens if I endure throwing myself against the wall. He was interested in the question of what happens to language at the moment that I impact the wall, and will it continue to be the same thing if it's the second time and the third time and the fourth time? And so he constructed a text, which has nothing to do, by the way, with what he's doing, but it's a magnificent text in itself, actually. It's one of Gary, who modestly says he's not a writer, is actually a very powerful writer. There's no text of his. If you ever extract any of the texts from any of his his works and read them in themselves, they're very challenging language acts in and of themselves. They would be perfectly fine just to publish those things and consider them as language acts of a very, very special and rather innovative kind, just because that's their nature. But you don't get to experience that in this piece. That language is swallowed by the piece. It's eaten by the piece. You have to find that out another way. And I actually would like to put it on the website of Slot here so people can actually read it. It's such a fantastic text. And it is in the book, right? That text? I think, yeah, it is in the book. That's right, it is in the book. It's just a great text. However, it's not about the greatness of the text. It's about what happens to something precious to him, that something powerful to him that he made in language that is now submitted to this particular thing that works out an idea that had been eating him since for 10, 15, 20, whatever it was, 20 years or whatever it was, before that he'd had this idea. And there are a number of Gary Hill powerful pieces that are made like that, of ideas that he'd had many, many years before. One of the great, great works, Tall Ships, was made from a little discovery he'd made 20 years before, but never done anything about. Anyway, the point that I'm making, really, is that these things happen as acts of intervention in his own awareness about what's possible. And they have that energy because that's how they're executed and how they're worked out. They're worked out with the kind of integrity. And if you were an art historian, how would you represent that? How would you inquire into the nature of the work that you could place it in a comparative relationship to other things? I mean, the one thing that art history has to do, since it calls itself history, is to look at a work in relationship to other works. This is a very core way that art intelligence deals with art. The thing that I want to say, though it may not be the kindest thing always to say, is that that sometimes obscures the very thing that makes us interested in art itself. That when you look at a work in terms of that comparative sense, you cannot find another, at least I have not found another work that would help you in understanding wall piece by comparison with it, unless your point was to note the difference. As I mentioned Barry LeVay's piece, it's important because that would come to mind almost immediately to anybody who knew the two pieces, and you'd wonder, is one influenced by the other? I'm almost virtually certain that Gary's piece is in no way influenced by Barry LeVay's. He didn't know about it. It just didn't have anything to do with it. So it becomes arbitrary to do the most logical thing. That is, the logical conclusion or the evident conclusion that you would draw from a comparison of two works becomes the arbitrary thing. But the thing that would not be arbitrary, and what would that be? It would be, in my mind, the thing that would bring you to the heart of the work. Otherwise, why are we dealing with art at all? Why is art special? Why is it different from anything else if we're not willing to be present for a work and go to the heart of what that work actually has to contribute? What if the heart of that work is obscured by our intelligence? This is a very difficult kind of question to ask, and I just submit that it's important to ask that question and to look at it that way, because art, if anything, if we're looking for why something is different from something else, is it different because this guy is now a great artist and we should be interested in everything he does, and therefore we'll study everything he does, but we won't study a work just for itself? What if his works really bear no relationship to each other? What if the singularity of the art act is such that the person stands outside of his own box or his own kind of thing at every moment? Anyway, that's a question I think one asks over and over again when you're dealing with an artist such as Gary Hill. I won't say like, because I don't think artists are like each other. I don't think that likeness is the issue.
We hate each other.
We may hate each other. Right. We may hate each other. Anyway, I mean, I'm not going to belabor, this is not a lecture, I don't want to belabor that point, but it really is what drives
me on that point.
it's what drives me to continue to do what I do in relationship to his work. And
Well, there's something. This is a kind of signature topic in our book, which we use the phrase "the further life of the work" in a number of different senses, and it's intended to signal a notion of how relating to work other than treating it as a finished object with its properties, its qualities, its capacity for comparison with other works, even to the point of its originality, its singularity. But that a work enters the world as a source for further life, assuming that the work enters the world initially as a kind of product of some kind of life, some kind of intensity, some kind of commitment, some kind of discovery, that its projection into the world should be the furtherance of that life. And that furtherance may be further work by the same artist, it may be work by other artists, it may be the thoughts of critics, or it may be simply the experiences that people have as they undergo it. And much of Gary's work is work that one doesn't simply witness. It's you undergo it. It challenges, transforms, screws you up, does all kinds of things to your sensorium, to your cognition, to your relationship to whatever you think the subject matter is. There is always a subject matter. It never exists in absolute abstraction from content. On the same time, it's never a representation of its content. It's constantly changing its relationships to what it means to have that kind of engagement. And it does so in a way which furthers one's own engagement with that material. So even the question of, well, this work seems to be related to that work, this work done this time has its connection to work that was done at another time, some possibilities realized at point X open up possibilities that are to be exploited at point omega or some other alphabet. Even that sense of comparison, it's not that there is no comparison or no connection. It's that the essential point is that there's a furtherance of its own investigation or its own projection or its own intensity. And so one has a unique, as a participant in the work or as an initiate of the work, one is in a unique position because to a certain extent one does actually appropriate it or appropriate oneself to it or expropriate oneself to the work by doing it because one is not quite the same after the engagement. So it's never a simple matter that as intelligent, sensitive, sophisticated art goers, attenders, we can engage with it in relationship to an unthreatened identity as a sophisticated art-appreciating person. It doesn't work that way. And we know this very well as people who are have tried to write about it and become involved, engaged with other people writing it, and what does that mean, and who are we that we're doing these things. That it challenges the not merely the notion of the identity of the artist or the identity of the critic or the identity of the art-going public, but of identity itself. One needs to enter into, and this is part of the meaning of this term liminal that we use promiscuously throughout the book and put it on the title, that you enter into a space that's not anchored anywhere. And that liminality is not viewed as a some kind of deficit to be run to the other shore as possible, but as something as a source of value in itself to be sustained and dwelled in. Okay, so now people want to talk. That's good.
Answer questions if we can. Tim.
No, he can't.
This is Tim Hyde, a wonderful artist who has a show right now at Philadelphia Museum that opened last night. So I urge everybody to see that show. It was really great.
It's great to see your work, Gary. But coming into the show, looking at tonight, it strikes me that it has nothing to do with language. And what I experienced walking in is how uncomfortable. places that are not well served by language. You know, the physicality of your body as an object, and how, you know, the sounds it makes and like the way it moves, all these things which don't easily fit into an idea of the structures of language. And I wonder if that's why it attracts people who do think in terms of words.
But I think that, you know, the very idea of language is slippery. And when I think about this, it seems cliche for me, but, you know, like, I don't know, this is, you know, probably a very distorted paraphrasing of Heidegger, when he talks about, like, you know, when you're at a loss for words, when you're speaking or... And you come to a moment when you can't think of the word, the language, to express yourself. That this moment is the very experience of what language is.
But I mean, don't you think that if you were so focused on language, don't you feel like
I'm not focused on language.
Right. I feel like it wouldn't happen to guys because you're saying you were.
I mean, no, they're not. I don't even know if they're focused on language. You know? Yeah. It's, what is language, anyway? Am I speaking? No, I think it's, now I'm going to go, I'm going to rub shoulders with this, my probably stupid saying about outsider art sort of thing or my background. It may very well be that a lot of what I do, what I go into the world as, has to do with feeling a lack of language, education, knowing. And so I'm a little warrior dealing with something that, it sounds silly, but really, most people do. They go through high school and they have a college education and they do all these things and they develop these things in certain ways. And, I just didn't do that. And I developed something on some other way. I'm not going to say it's not naive. It's not it's not stupid. For whatever reason, it seems to have interfaced or met minds that have gone through these things that. I mean, we think of language and knowledge and this, knowing, it kind of, suggests these worlds, education, how to speak, how to write, how, all this kind of thing, and so for however many years I remain kind of ambiguous about this space, even though I can very well say that, when people have regrets or something like this, in some ways I regret, maybe not, going to college. But it's not really so much for knowledge; it's to have fun, like social. What? Yeah, maybe. I don't really know. No. Anyway, this phrase, the further life of the work, I've very recently, actually within the last 24 hours, I've had this phrase inverted on me, which has really become the further work of the life. And I found out my wife, Magdalena, is pregnant, and we're going to have a child. Oh. So these kinds of things probably affect, my work more than whether it's language or not.
Augustine is quoted as having said, when asked the question, what is time, which is even more maddening, maybe, than the question of what is language or what is life, he said, everybody knows what time is until you ask them. And I think that's exactly the right thing to say about language. You know, nobody has a problem understanding what language is until you try to figure it out. You know, and in a sense, that's what our book is about. It's about how that question gets asked in really different ways over and over again in Gary's work. It's not really that his work is about language. When we wrote this piece on tall ships, and we were talking to Gary a lot at that point, Tall Ships is a work in which there's no language at all. The only language is the title, Tall Ships. And you walk into a long hall, and there are small lights on the wall in a dark room, hall-like room. And as you walk by them, as you get closer, you realize that these little dots of light are people, a person. Each is a person sitting in the distance. And as you approach that person, the person gets up and walks toward you and stands in front of you, and you just stand there. And that person just stands looking at you, sort of life-size, and you're looking at that person. And you go through all of the emotions, oddly, knowing this is not a high-tech thing. It's done with very, very low-tech lenses and so on, just right through. And it's black and white. And yet, you go through all of the emotions as if you were looking at a person standing right in front of you, and you feel silly, you don't know what to say, you feel uncomfortable. That person's feeling uncomfortable. He or she is kind of shifting around, feeling weird about looking at you like this, and you're feeling weird about looking. And all those things about, I would never want to, why am I looking at this person? I'm not the kind of person that, all that kind of psychological babble that goes on in the mind when you meet somebody happens to you inside this piece, right? And yet this is a piece that has no language in it. But the piece is totally about language. It's completely about language. It's like you're dealing with language at every moment that you're in the piece. Did Gary think of it that way? I don't think so, because when we're writing this piece, he asked me, or asked us, the question, is this piece about language? And Chuck had the right answer. He said, it's about language if you say it is. You know, and that's basically where the question lies. It's a radical choice to engage yourself with language. We don't do that. We just basically we live at the effect of language being the dominant force in our environment, really. And our language, if you're into the Lacan view of things, you know, that's a construct that never lets you be free. You're always locked into the way in which you compromised yourself from word one, you know. And you're dealing with that. You're stuck in that situation.
You know, these later pieces seem to be these extreme forms of crashing against some kind of a wall, one side of which is maybe that question. Like this one up here, this image is at the beginning of chapter 10 in our book, and we hadn't seen the piece, but every time I got to it while we were working on it and doing editing on it, I would get to that image on the page, I would freak out. I didn't want to look at that image. And I didn't even see I didn't even see the fact that there was a reflection there. So this thing looks like you have this demon who happens to be Gary Hill throwing himself on a jet force up against a reflective image of himself, trying to get into it, to become it, to destroy it, all of those things. I keep thinking of, there's that moment in Moby Dick where Ahab is talking about the forehead of the whale, and he builds it up in such a way that it's like the mask of God, and he takes the spear and he says, strike through the mask. That sort of has the ferocious force of that. So if you put language in there as one of the things that this is attempting to express, or to more than maybe it's an actual theurgic event. It's a magical event, an attempt not just to express anything, but to perform something in relationship to that question. How could a body, particularly a body that has been so complexly and problematically represented and self-represented as Gary's body, throw itself into its own face and
and release the hydrogen bomb that's the stealth bomber that's going into the mirror of itself. I mean, it's amazing.
On that note, if anybody has a really driving question, we might entertain it. But I think otherwise, we're pressing against the limits of the wall of this time zone, not knowing either what time is or walls are or anything. We are at the limit. Anybody got a driving question? Osvaldo.
I don't know why, but for me, the work of Gary is more of an impossibility of marriage.
Impossibility of marriage.
It's not the same
yeah.
thing.
Well,
the second, I don't know why, but it comes to my mind that metaphor, according to Biko, is before language. And I believe that one of the things that teaches the work of him, if something can be teaching now, mm-hmm. is that the metaphorical capacity of the work overcome the interpretation and overcome also the possibility of language. And that's what makes it work so different from all the other video art.
Oh, yeah. But, you know, the so-called impossibility of language, however, is a paradox or an aporia in itself. You cannot say that. You cannot say language is impossible. You've undone yourself in the very statement. So we could talk about the relative or something.
Well, it's that, you know, you get into the whole Lacanian. There's a truth in it, which is that the impossibility of language is itself an expression of an enormous desire that the impossible fact of language creates.
Hans Heidegger.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, actually, I would be very curious to see what exactly would you think was classical?
Well, remind me that teleclassical in the sense that it was quite beautiful and quite literary in a classical sense, where your body seems to be making you sort of primitive gestures or utterances. Oh. The combination was interesting to me, and I don't know if that was conscious.
Well, I think. In certain ways, you know, for this exhibition, as thinking of an exhibition as a work, yes, you know, trying to kind of smear the way that you know, reverb or resonance smears things together, you know, you just kind of not only the contrast of the difference of something very obviously extremely having to do with physicality. And something that, you know, there are words and there's sense, and meaning. Although, Body Things Again, the model has to do with nonsense, which is just around the corner here. You know, it also has to do with this is, you know, 2008, you know, just made. And this is, these pieces here are, you know, 20, 25, 30 years old. And to somehow to kind of synaptically kind of attack that notion of time of, you know, this is then. Oh, this is recent. This is new. This is, and how really. That's okay. That's okay. Well, that's whatever. But maybe that's worth we're looking at because this has something to do with that, you know, a kind of circularity between, you know, body and mind, and that, you know, when we think of you know, of here and now or then and when or, you know, how sometimes these things kind of collapse in strange ways, you know. If they don't, then yes, something becomes, you know, what, mortified and fossilized, and, you know, we no longer think about it. I don't know. Sometimes I think about some of these Dylan performances where he performs these works from, you know, 30, 40 years ago. And he does these amazing things with the grain of his voice that reinvigorates one to think about. It's a song even before perhaps it is the lyrics of the song that everyone is attached to, you know, the 60s and what he was saying and everything. But what he's trying to do is actually kind of show you that the song, there's something present and existent in the song itself that is outside that language, that is a, you know, a mystery that has a life of its own. And, you know, it's like trying to, you know, make that, show that, you know.
Yeah.
No, I mean, I think these things are, you know, I don't know, whatever.
Well, I think our time is up. I just want to say that this is a very special exhibit of Gary's work, because I don't think it's ever happened that these very early works and very recent works, the work in the front, Up Against Down, this is the American premiere of that work. It was actually shown only in France, right? And it's probably the East Coast premiere, I think, of Walpies. I haven't seen it. Anyway. And these two pieces in this room, which are mid-80s pieces, are great pieces, actually. They're both 30 minutes. They require that one see them, actually, sit and see them. What's really nice about this is it's pretty comfortable here to actually see these pieces in depth, and I just want to invite everybody to consider coming back when there aren't so many folks around to actually experience the pieces, because they're really great. Okay, thank you for coming.